are now listening to the Serious Growth Podcast with your host, Leo Costa Jr.
Mark, how long have you known Tom?
Ooh. I want to say early 90s. I think I met him 91, 92, somewhere in there.
Well, first of all, I have to tell you that anybody who's a friend of Tom's is a friend of mine, so you're stuck with me now.
Thank you, sir. It's an honor. He's spoken over the years, sir.
Oh, man. I mean, Tom's a great guy, man. I did an interview with him yesterday, and it's always something. It's like a couple of buddies get together, and it's always something new and something old, you know. It's really cool. Yeah. Yep. Anyway, well, listen, welcome to Serious Growth Podcast. And the mission in this program is to tell it like it is, you know, tell the truth. Sometimes the truth is hard to swallow because it's counter popular or counterintuitive, but on this show it doesn't matter. We want to set the record straight and tell it like it is. And I'm looking at your bio. It's very impressive, and I think the best thing to do is, what obviously the arts has been something that's a huge part of your life. Maybe you can tell us how this whole journey that have been on, how it started.
Really, I mean, like you mentioned, the martial arts have kind of been the lens through which I've looked at everything else in my life. Yeah. It's been a passion of mine since I was little. And it's something that, you know, ideally we find things in life where if we put in a little bit of energy, we put in a lot of energy, we get some sort of, like, you know, ROI, some sort of return on investment.
Yeah.
And really the martial arts have been the only thing that I found in life where, like, if you put in 5%, you'll get at least 5% back, if not more. Yeah. And so over time I found that, like, no matter how many different arts I studied, no matter how many different things that I've gone into, no matter where I've pointed my efforts in life, everything comes back to the same training methods, principles, ethics that I've learned in martial arts.
Yeah. So it's been like your foundation then.
Yes, sir. Exactly. Yeah.
So how did you get into the arts to begin with? Were you influenced by parents, friends, or maybe somebody you saw in the movies?
A little bit of all of the above. I mean, like, it's undeniable that, you know, popular culture had something to do with it. I mean, like, yeah. I was lucky to grow up in an era where, like, you know, on the weekends you turn on the TV and you'd see, like, Kung Fu cinema or whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And having martial arts be a part of popular culture was like, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Certainly I had a little bit of an advantage with my dad, who gave me a little bit of a foundation in just basics of kicking and punching, you know, martial art mechanics. And then when I was around 10, 9 or 10, he started introducing me to Tai Chi.
Okay.
Which I think in a lot of ways, on a philosophical level, certainly on a physical level, put me ahead of the curve in a lot of ways. But unfortunately, my own stubbornness made me backtrack and go the other way.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, to be understood by kids.
Well, okay. So Tai Chi, I mean, I know pretty much what it is. I was over in years and years ago. I traveled through parts of Asia. I believe where I saw this going on was Hong Kong maybe or something. But yep. Now is Tai Chi, I saw people on the side of the road, like, doing certain things like holding poses. Is that what Tai Chi is?
Tai Chi, as my understanding of it goes, is a martial art. In my experience,
okay.
my understanding of it is a martial art. So there are exercises within the martial art that can be posture-based or pose-based, almost like yoga asanas, that are part of the warm-ups or part of the strength training.
Uh-huh.
But as far as the totality of Tai Chi, it's a martial art.
Okay. Yeah.
Most people these days don't really practice it with combat in mind. They practice it more as, like, just, you know, active movement.
When you say warming up, because, you know, one of the things I learned when I was traveling in the late 80s over in the East Bloc, the Bulgarians, I was in Bulgaria and I studied and trained with their Olympic teams, them, Russia. And one of the things that was pretty fascinating to me was, they didn't believe in stretching or warming up before going into, they called it battle or combat. And they said that you basically teach the body what you want it to do, and warming up is a waste of time, in a nutshell, which I found really incredible, because I came from you know, I was bodybuilding at that particular time. And back then it was like, we'd warm up with, you know, a few warm-up sets before we did a working set. Now, when you said a warm-up, now, are you actually warming up and doing the exercises or doing the art itself as to, you know, what you're going to do, or is it a mental warm-up?
If your question is geared more towards like that Tai Chi thing that I just mentioned, I can't necessarily speak for those individual teachers. Like for myself, having trained under Pavel Tsitsulin, the guy who's basically the godfather of the kettlebell movement here in outside of the Soviet Union. Pavel's thing, I can remember many times training with Pavel, and he'd be like, "Yeah, you know, sir, should I go warm up?" He'd be like, "Grab that bell, go do some swings. Grab that bell, go do some get ups. Like, just go right into it."
Yeah. So ready on demand.
Ready on demand.
Yeah. So it kind of follows that same. It sounds like it follows that same philosophy of just being ready.
It's interesting. I think depending on the training method and also depending on the frame of mind, the, you know, activity level of the person that comes to the training session, I think individuals require different things. Like if you've come to the training session and you're amped up and you're ready to go and you're focused, you've got that mental energy, you've got that physical energy, you've got that metabolic kind of rush going into it, right? Mm-hmm. Then, yeah, there's no need to like warm up. Yeah. But if you've been static for a while, like you've just had a long drive, you're tired, you just stumbled out of the car to get to the gym or whatever, then maybe a little bit of movement first to get blood flowing, to get the tissues more elastic, I think that can be more valuable.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's a one size fits all.
Okay. And when you got into the arts, did you compete in competitions, or was there a natural progression to where you've gotten to this point?
I didn't do a whole lot of competition myself. My parents were almost always like, "Hey, the time that you spend on competition, you better get your ass back in those books." So it's like,
"Oh, what are those parents?"
Sorry?
One of those parents.
Yes, yes.
That's good.
Coming up, I was lucky. They kept me on the straight and narrow.
Yeah.
For most things.
All right, let's take a quick break so I can tell you about our product.
Do you want a bone-crushing grip? Good, because you're going to get one with the amazing new TRS Gripper. It's a progressive grip builder with longer handles and a special ergonomic design that's like a dozen hand grippers in one. Start off easy and work your way up to quickly build your grip strength from wet noodle to pulverizing. The package includes a video from the world-famous strength coach, Dr. Russ Horine, the man who worked with Leo Costa to help bring you big beyond belief in the Bulgarian power burst. Dr. Horine shows you a simple and easy to follow workout plan that takes just minutes a day right from in front of your TV set if you want. So click on the link below and let's get started building you a stronger, firmer, bone-crushing grip.
Okay, so did it transition at some point? I see here that you're the founder of, you're called K3 Combat Movement Systems. And yes. So what is that, you know, how did you get into that side of it?
So throughout history, if you look at most old school and even current martial cultures, right, like combat cultures, whether it's, you know, the ancient Greeks, whether it's African tribal methods, whether it's Chinese martial arts, whether it's current spec ops, there are physical practices that warriors use to prepare themselves for battle, but also restore themselves. So like if you have a warrior culture that's just trained on, that's just focused on pushing itself and not restoring itself, those operatives or those soldiers will break quickly, right? They'll have very limited shelf life. Mm-hmm. And also these people will be great cannon fodder. They will never make leaders.
Okay.
And so for me, one of the things that I was able to identify was that in certain of these cultures where there's like a rich philosophy as well as a rich restorative element as well as a rich medical element, there are patterns there. And so to be able to identify those patterns and then extract them and not necessarily use them within the context of fighting, but also to use them in the context of training, in some ways pretty similar to what Tom has done. Okay. With his athletes to be able to take those ideas and not only apply them for high level athletes, but also apply those to people that are in need of rehab as well, has been my focus through K3.
Okay. And when you're talking about training athletes for strength, and also, because what I am hearing from you, and I like to always relate this to, because my background is in sports-specific training and bodybuilding, and it's been all done with weights, pretty much, yes. Okay? And so when I hear you saying that the people that are out there that break down much quicker, are these the people that are, see, we would call that going into an overtraining syndrome.
Yes.
You get to the point that your body just can't go anymore and it shuts you down.
Yes.
It'll pull a muscle. It'll just shut you down at some point. I've been shut down before many times because I think that is even part of the learning process is to keep playing with where that line is. And then totally. at least for me, I don't know if
sure.
Okay. And then you sort totally of start good. Learning that, right?
The thing that, sorry to cut you off, sir, but I think of the things super important is that, like, we are so, especially as athletes when we're on the up slope, like, we so want to please our coaches. We so want to please our mentors. We want to be able to compete and stand out. So the drive, right, that to be able to, like, push ourselves is really important. But the best athletes, I think, also learn, like, the ones that have the longest career, and the longest ability to continue to improve rather than spike and drop hard and spike and drop hard. The ones that don't really hit those hard drops are the ones that learn to listen to their bodies.
Yeah.
And know when, like, okay, I'm pushing, but now this is becoming counterproductive.
Yeah. And that's a hard thing to do because you have to trust your instincts. And for me, you know, again, I'm relating to how I learned it. It's like, I don't really know what my instincts are at that point because I'm too early on in that process, you know? And one of the things that I talked about in one of the training courses, which goes to what you're saying, I said the athletes that are training in bodybuilding, what happens is we called it a training zone. The optimal training zone is where you need to be. And what happens with most athletes, because, you know, the mindset of a warrior or the mindset of an athlete can work for and against you. And
yes, sir.
In these cases, you know, you train and you just keep going more and more and more. And all of a sudden you crash out the top of that optimal training zone and your body, it overtrains and you start coming back through that optimal training zone and you train a little bit there. And all of a sudden you're under training. So you're constantly going through the training zone. I think that's what you're talking about. And it's to learn how to think of it as driving on a road and staying in between those lines. And that's your training.
That's a beautiful image right there that you mentioned right there, like staying between the lines so that you're like, you know, you're not crossing over into oncoming traffic.
Right.
Not
right.
Driving off the edge of the cliff. I mean, yeah. that's really important. And I think, you know, one of the guys that I've had the fortune to study with, Coach Mark Rifkin has said that, like, you know, you can push yourself and you can hit the PR and hit the PR and hit the PR. But then, like, if you keep pushing yourself like that, you will pay for it.
Yeah.
So the question that I think a lot of our athletes and certainly a lot of our coaches have to keep in mind is, like, do you want to or can you afford to pay for it?
Yeah.
And if that paying for it means, like, you know, in the best case, okay, you take some downtime, you miss a couple of practices, you go take it a little bit easier. Worst case scenario is, like, you're severely injured, you need surgery, or that's a career ending injury.
Exactly.
You know, like, these are, you know, I think the most responsible athletes and certainly the coaches, especially, like, the coaches, right? The most responsible coaches are the ones that have that Hippocratic oath in mind, do no harm.
Right. Well, and that's true, man. And, you know, when I used to train a lot of Major League Baseball players and football players, all the guys at the highest level. And those guys were actually the most difficult to train. I mean, not only were they highly paid, and there came a little bit of a, you know, I know more than you do, Mr. Trainer.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes, sir.
And, of course, the way I got their attention was that I called it putting them over the rail because I had certain training techniques that they weren't used to. So I just go make them toss cookies, and then I got their attention, okay? We had to develop that line of who's the boss here, you know, without being an asshole about it. And sure. But so not only did they have that mentality and making a lot of money, yeah, I mean, it goes with that, you know, being at that level, but they also were so – focused and so, you know what I mean? It's like, I think what you're saying is like, as a coach and as their trainer, you had to be willing to say, you need to do this way because of what you just said about getting hurt. And it's counterintuitive. And it's a really hard thing to trust for these athletes. So when you're training your people, your strength training, for example, what does that look like? And how do you handle these athletes?
First thing I say in the door is this: how well do you perform when you're hurting, when you're aching, when you're sore, when you feel like you just got your ass handed to you? Invariably, every athlete goes like, yeah, that wouldn't be so great. I go, how would you feel if you like got onto the field and you feel like, yeah, I'm rested, I'm eager, I want to go kick ass. Like, you're hungry. Like, yeah, that'd be great. Okay. So which one of those two ways do you want to leave this training session? Do you want to feel like I just kicked your ass, or do you want to feel like you're ready to go kick ass?
Yeah.
And when I phrase it like that, almost everyone chooses the latter of the two.
Yeah.
And so then I go on to explain like, hey, this is really simple. My job is to give you just enough training that your tissues, your nervous system, your whole body, your entire being changes so that you get stronger, you get faster, and you're more resilient. But I never, ever want to leave you, like have you leave these training sessions feeling like you aren't ready to perform better than you can or better than you could when you walked in here.
Yeah. And I think that the distinction between great trainers and coaches compared to most of the other ones that don't know what the hell they're talking about is that you give them, as their instructor, you give them the why. And you're making them answer that question. And even when they answer those questions, logically, they understand it. But when they get in that moment, this is where you have to have that strong hand and say, you know, if I told you that you're going to get worse results by doing this more and more and more, do you still want to do that? You know, type thing. And I think it's a tricky thing to be able to have that, you know, what an athlete wants and what an athlete needs is really kind of up to you. And when you're talking about, especially dealing with athletes that are, their living sort of depends on that, you know?
Right. Right. I think for me, one of the rules that I have, I say first day in is like the moment I call a rep, the moment I call it, like your set is done.
Yeah.
I don't give a shit what rep you're on. You put that weight down. You put that, you cease that exercise. You cease that movement.
Yeah.
And so most athletes, especially the pros, like, or the ones that want to be pros, they'll push themselves. It's like, if you say our goal is 20 reps of whatever, right? They're like, yeah, I'm going to hit that.
Right.
But if by the fifth rep, the technique or the form degrades to the point where like, it becomes more of them compensating their way through the exercise rather than actually building that strength, building that coordination. Yeah. Then, and I call it, then they're like, five reps. You said we were going to do like 20. Yeah. And then there's that like, oh, I want to get this.
Yeah. And that's what always bugged me about when I saw trainers that were working off a clipboard with their clients. You know, they were using the clipboard and using what they did last time instead of paying attention to what the hell was going on right in front of them. Because, you know, it's where everything is always in flux. And you as a coach, you need to be aware of that because they're in this mindset of they just want to keep doing more and more. And all those alerts that their body is giving them, they're not paying attention to that shit.
Right. Totally.
I don't know if that's how you feel, but that's what I saw. And that's what I saw for myself, too.
I was getting ready to say, it's so funny to hear you say that because I was getting ready to say, like, man, I feel a little bit guilty hearing that because I've been that guy. I've been that guy that just, oh, you know, like I have it in my head today that I'm going to do 100 of these kicks or 100 of these swings or like however many kettlebell snatches. And there have been times when I've allowed myself to kind of veer outside of the safety lines and just oops.
Oops. Yeah. And hopefully. Yeah, you do. In some way, you do. But again, that's part of the learning process. Okay, so when you train these athletes, are you training them with traditional free weight? Is it a combination of free weight, machine, kettlebells? How does that actually look? And what is kind of the regimen that you put them on? Where do they start? You know, there's an end game to all this. You're trying to make them a better athlete. But what does that look like? And what are you using for the tools?
As far as the tools I use, it really depends on what's available to me. Sometimes, like if I have to go train an athlete or train work with a group, like especially if it's like a tactical group, they may have a limited amount of equipment there on site and they need to have exercises or need to have training methods that are going to be able to suit what they've got and also what they've got to live in. So what's the right word I'm looking for? the tools, the equipment, the methodology really, really changes depending on what group I'm working with. Like ideally, I think, you know, having stuff like some kettlebells, having some, you know, certainly like a matted space to be able to do movement, rolling, things like that, that are going to be great for vestibular inputs, things like that would be great.
Yeah.
But outside of that, it's, you know, it's all icing on the cake.
Yeah. So you have to let form follow function and modify on the fly, so to speak. Whatever is in front of you, you got to make the best of what you got.
That's been kind of my calling card. I mean, like instead of being the guy that's like always the kettlebell guy or always the, you know, Oli bar guy or always the Bulgarian bag guy or always the martial arts guy, right?
Yeah.
I think if you understand the principles well, you should be able to take those principles and personalize them to whoever, right?
Yeah.
So that's been my thing.
Okay, so when you're working with that now, do you work with all level and different athletes? So is there a certain group that you, I know you said something about tactical group. What does that mean, like the military?
Military, law enforcement. So I've had the chance to work with a couple of units over the years. Same thing with, you know, as far as sports, like all levels of performance. I mean, in my private practice, I may be working with, you know, a kid who's prepping for Little League or something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, as far as when it comes to consulting, I may be consulting, let's say, for like U.S. speed skating, which I accompanied the U.S. Olympic speed skating team to Korea in 2018 for the Winter Games.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on who I'm working with, it might, I mean, it could really run the gamut. I could be working with the NBA player or Major League Baseball player. I've been really fortunate in the sense that like my experience has kind of run that gamut.
Yeah, sounds like it. And then do you have like a certain, in your program, are you going doing like an 8-week program, 12-week? What does that look like?
I really personalize depending on the group or depending on the individual, like especially if I have to peak them in a certain way. Like a lot of times I don't know when I'm going to get onboarded, right? So like depending on how long I have to work with this particular athlete and when they have to be able to peak, and also working in conjunction, especially if I'm working with an athlete, I have to work in conjunction with their other coaches.
Yeah, true that.
So, you know, if I just program for them as if it's just me that's doing everything, but then they also have other load that they have to accommodate for, whether that load is travel, whether that load is like hard training from their other coaches, or whether that load is like back-to-back games, you know, I have to be able to waive the load, or we meaning me and the athlete, have to be able to waive the load intelligently based on what they've got coming up.
Yeah.
Like I think a lot of coaches just think that the only stressor is their workout. And I think that's a little myopic. We have to be able to understand that our athletes are going to be able to perform based on what the sum of their loads are, including like their diet, their social life, their whatever, right? It's like,
it's all factored in.
Totally. I mean, if you've got an athlete that, you know, may have had a big fight or an argument, you know, with his significant other, and then you've got to, you know, handle that. There are times when you're going to get more out of your athlete and protect your athlete better, build your athlete better by not beating the shit out of them.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a, you know, it's sometimes coaches just don't get, really good coaches and trainers don't get enough kudos, you know, because you're really paying attention to all those things. And that does definitely create a better or worse outcome. One of the things I learned when I was working with I learned this actually through the baseball, Major League Baseball, is that the athletes in that sport, the depending on the position that they play, there is a list of priorities in that position that go from the most important things that you need to do in that position to the least. Is that something that you also deal with? Like when you're dealing with your athletes, like for example, let's just say a speed skater, there's certain, you know, in order to make those athletes compete at the highest level, you got to make sure that you're training according to what that particular sport and position of sport in some cases needs. Do you address that with your athletes?
I think that a good coach in terms of strength and conditioning, and certainly a good medical professional, has got to be able to address both sports specific training as well as general physical preparedness. Like if you focus too much on one, you're missing out on the other for the athlete. Mm-hmm. I think for what a good strength and conditioning professional should be able to do is widen the inventory of movement, available inventory of movement. So like, let's say an athlete needs this much, like maybe let's say, I don't know, however much movement inventory for their particular sport. But if for whatever reason their body is out of position or needs to get back into that like comfort zone, they need to have just a little bit wider inventory available to them to be able to get back in, you know, if they found themselves out. And those little areas of being outside the norm, those are where injuries can occur. Those are where major stresses occur. Mm-hmm. So if we give our athletes greater strength, greater control, greater ease, greater like mastery of those extra ranges of motion, we're having better athletes.
Yeah. In your program, when you're dealing with your, whether it's athletes or just, you know, sort of the regular people, fitness people, whatever, how much of the arts, as far as maybe the mental training, do you push on to them? Is that part of your program? Is it teaching that, or is that something that is learned just as a result of doing repetitions and discipline coming along with that?
It's intrinsic. Like with K3 combat, movement systems, K3 combat, one of the things that I do is like, I try and build drills that are coordination based, right? So at the beginning, you just learn these patterns of movement. And so as you practice these patterns of movement, you build coordination, right? But then once we practice those drills, then we take them into a reactive setting. So you're going to work a particular drill, but now you have to do it in a way where you're reacting to a stimulus and you can't just go on cruise control. Yeah. And so the more reaction we have there, the mind has to be in focus. The mind has to be able to handle perturbations. So if there's something that like, oh, I'm in the zone. Great. I'm in the zone. Oh, that feels like good. I'm in the zone. But then you can't handle when something tries to knock you out of the zone and find your way back into the zone. It's fragile.
Yeah.
And it's not that useful. So part of the mental training is to be able to guide someone into feeling what the zone is like, but then also too, right, the more anti-fragility we can build into that, right, the more we can shake the tree and then like not have everyone fall out of it,
right,
then so much the better.
Yeah. And I think when you do something like that, you've really, really, you know, created a well-rounded individual, not only physically, but also obviously emotionally, it sounds like.
Yeah. Clutch. Because yeah. I think a lot of athletes, like the moment they get a little bit, I mean, athletes aside, any human being, right, pulls on our chain. The moment someone gets that, like, knows how to press our buttons and we yeah. have that emotional reaction,
yeah,
we're driving, we're living our lives, we're driving with the parking brakes on.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
So if we're able to identify where those, like, hot buttons are or identify where those parking brakes are and either, like, make them less sensitive to the point where like you've really got to jam on that parking brake, something like obscene for the car to slow down, or just totally defuse it altogether where it's like something's oncoming and you can just manage to maneuver your way out of it.
Yeah.
Even better.
Well, yeah. And you know what? There's an Italian term. It's a fashion term. It's called sprezzatura. And what that basically means in fashion, and it applies to sport as well. It means it's watching somebody that plays at the highest level and how they make it look easy. You know, that shit just yep. doesn't fucking happen, right? It just doesn't. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of them. You go, man, they make that look so easy. But all the hours and training and the hours to get to that point where you said a word, where it does become reactionary. You don't think yep. about that stuff. And yet you're in the middle of, you know, as an athlete, you're in the middle of all this pressure. And those, the top guys at the very top make it look like it's pretty seamless and pretty easy, boy. And I tell you what, it's something to watch. And, you know, I don't know if, you know, a lot of people just really get it until you're actually down on that field or on that court to see how fast all those decisions are being made. I mean, I've seen like they showed like sometimes in the NFL football, these quarterbacks, they show them dropping back. And how they do these reads and how quick all those things are and how they put that ball to the smallest window. I mean, we don't even get that, you know, how hard that is sometimes because they make it look so damn easy. I think that's kind of what you're talking about a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, the more we can get our whole being, not just our eyes, like not just being able to scan the visual field, but to be able to sense with all of our senses, right? Not like our, not just vision, but also maybe like our audio, our ears, right? Yeah. Our sense of smell, whatever, right? Like just that the totality of the sensory experience and being able to interpret that and then react to that in a successful fashion, or maybe let's say like a combatively successful fashion,
yeah, right?
In a tactical situation, that's the ultimate.
Yeah. Okay. So as you know, the longer you play sport, there, it's not a question of if you're going to get hurt, but when.
Yes.
It's going to happen. Yeah. It's a hard fact to face, and you just hope can tolerate that. And I see here that you do physical therapy, and you have something here called functional movement systems. What exactly now does that mean?
Okay. I'm not a physical therapist. I've had the good fortune of studying with many of the best physical therapists. One of whom is the founder of Functional Movement Systems, a gentleman by the name of Gray Cook.
Okay, I see that, yeah.
So Gray created, along with Dr. Lee Burton and a couple of other people, created a tool called the Functional Movement Screen. And the Functional Movement Screen is basically seven movement patterns that we put people through to identify, like, possible landmines in their movement. Like if there's a lack of range of movement or a lack of control of a range of movement, we want to identify what those issues are that lie at the bottom of that to be able to help these athletes or help these movers or help these people go through their lives and perform and train better.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I'm lucky because even though my doctorate, my PhD is in Chinese medicine and acupuncture, as far as my tool set, my skill set, my education as far as that goes, and certainly postdoctorally, has been very Western. So spending a lot of time with people like Greg Cook, Dr. Burton, Dr. Kyle Kiesel, other people like that, I mean, have really just opened my eyes.
Yeah. And I assume that what you end up doing then is you take a little bit of, you know, from each one that works for you and you incorporate that or implement that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think my thought process is what has really changed the most, because instead of looking at everything in terms of meridians or acupuncture points or herbs or what have you, right? It's like there's having more than one paradigm in medicine is almost like having multiple languages that you can speak, right? Mm-hmm. You can communicate an idea in multiple ways. So you can, if you have multiple ways of treating a patient or improving a patient or helping a patient, you have more ways of reaching out to them, reaching into their body, not necessarily manually or with a needle, but finding where they are and then helping them get past whatever limitation that they've got with.
Yeah. So with regard to acupuncture, is this something that you use mainly to heal people, or is it something that you can do as we talk about a pre-workout and a post-workout supplement. Now, is there any such thing? I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm just asking a random question, believe me. But is there something that you could do through acupuncture for an athlete that will actually help them perform as well, use the acupuncture as a tool to help them recover?
Depending on the athlete and the situation, yes. So if an athlete comes in and there's a particular part of the body that may not be functioning well, like something's triggered up, something's not moving well, a part of the body is hypertonic, then yeah, using acupuncture can be great because it'll allow them suddenly to have greater ranges of motion in areas that were heretofore limited and forcing them to compensate.
Yeah.
So that, you know, as let's say a lead in before training or before sport competition could be clutch. As far as the athlete that's totally performing well, and maybe they just want to feel like a little bit of a smoother energy flow and relaxation, there are styles and methods of acupuncture that accomplish that as well.
And is it something that you would, I know maybe it depends on the athlete, but is it something that you would say, look, as an athlete, I would recommend as your coach that maybe you do acupuncture twice a week, three times a week. Is there anything that is like a regimen that you would recommend, or is this something that you do sort of on the fly and kind of what's what they really need?
Everything for me on my from my perspective is very individualized. Like, yeah. I know it's kind of frustrating because a lot of my friends are like, hey, dude, so give me some sets and reps and like,
yeah,
give me a program. And I'm like, who are we talking about? And then they're like, well, can you just give me a general program? And I'm like, you know, that's like giving diet advice. I mean, like everyone's microbiome is different. So like if for some people, like, great, eating red meat is wonderful. For other people whose digestive systems aren't necessarily geared for that, you may cause them like all kinds of like GI pain. Like, so we've got to understand who we're dealing with and what their goals are, and then when we're dealing with them.
Okay. So as a coach, do you also train people to become someone like yourself as a coach? Do you do, are you in that field, or is it, are you mainly coaching people?
I'm a master SFG instructor for StrongFirst, which is Pavel Tsulin's organization for kettlebell instruction, or actually strength training in general. I've been for, I first got certified under him in 2006. And so it's been about almost 15 years that I've been teaching, you know, under or representing him in some way, shape, or form. As a master instructor, I'm actually allowed to conduct certifications underneath the StrongFirst banner. So yeah, I've been part of training other fitness and strength training professionals for some time now.
Yeah, because my question is this: how long did it take you to trust your instinct? I'm a firm believer that I try out everything on myself first.
Yeah, I'm the same. I'm totally the same.
I have to, you know, because I have to have that to be able to feel legit about, you know, passing that information on. Okay. So, but how, you know, that takes obviously a certain amount of time to trust the instinct. Have you ever heard of a bodybuilder named Tom Platz?
Yeah, of course.
Golden Eagle.
Legendary.
Yeah. Tom and I trained together, and he's the one that really made me understand, trust your instinct, because Tom was like very instinctual. I mean, he was doing stuff that I was just like, well, this is, you know, I was at that point, I'm more regimented because I don't have the experience. So my question to you is, you know, how long did it take you to start trusting your own instinct, and how do you pass that on to somebody else? You know what I mean? Obviously it's not something that just happens.
You know, to be totally honest with you, I feel like I'm learning more every single training session, every single day. It's like, oh man, I could push a little bit harder than I thought, or wow, maybe I should have dialed it back a little bit. Maybe I shouldn't have gone that extra little bit. I mean, Pavel Tsitsulin has a great kind of metric, and his thing is like, always leave 2 quality reps in the bank.
Yeah.
And so the thing is with that, it's like, if I always feel like I could have done 2 more perfect reps, I should never be injured.
Right.
You know, so like if I can keep pushing and keep pushing and keep pushing, and like maybe someday I'll chart, like if I'm charting my stuff, right, and being very disciplined about it, seeing the numbers improve, right? As the numbers are improving, but I'm like, and I'm growing stronger, I'm able to put up more weight, but I'm not hurt, then that's the proof in the pudding.
Yeah, because, you know, again, it's one thing for you to have this knowledge and be able to train your athletes and be confident, but to a fledgling trainer, you know, who you're getting ready to go out there and say, here you go. You know, I just, you know, I wonder how long does it take for them to really start trusting that? And how long do you stay? I mean, do you stay with them like a certain amount of time? It seems like to me, like you've become a master, but you've been under somebody's guidance, I guess you might say, to the point where now you can fly, you know, but how do you do that with a new trainer?
I think it's tough. I think new trainers really have so much. I mean, just in every other facet of our lives and our world, we have so much. We've never been in a time in history where we've had easy access to so much information.
That's true.
But along with that, there's so much misinformation.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Scary. I mean, actually.
Totally. So we've got people out there saying like, you know, oh, you want to get buff? Then great, do this. And it's like, the programming is really well written out. It's visually compelling, but taking that from like, let's say the guy that's never lifted a weight in his life and trying to pull some of those weights, do some of those sets of reps, you're going to have someone that's going to be, you know, in a doctor's office in a week,
yeah,
you know, because he's hurt. And like, these are the things where I feel like we as fitness professionals need to understand first and foremost that we have an obligation as wellness professionals.
Yeah.
And as wellness professionals, we need to make sure that people are not getting hurt on our watch.
Yeah. You know, one of the reasons why I'm doing this, the podcasting, I took a layoff out of the, I wrote a bunch of training courses for bodybuilding and, you know, then we got away from it. I took about a 13-year layoff, decided to come back. But when I came back, you know, and like you said, when I first started in 82, the amount of information that you can get now compared to 82, and we're getting pretty good information back then, but it's just like, it's ridiculous. And like you said, so much of the good stuff goes along with a lot of the bad stuff that's out there too. And, you know, if you don't really know what that, and the poor unsuspecting person that's reading that stuff.
God help you.
Oh yeah. God help you. Because I started reading some of the stuff on Google and I was going, what the hell am I, what am I seeing here? What the, you know, and I can tell, and I'm sure you're the same way. I can tell. And I know sometimes these people that are writing the articles, you know, you can be in an interview with somebody and tell them, look, I want you to say it just like this. And they end up saying it the way they want. And they're the ones that butcher the article. And I take that in consideration, but I can tell in about 3 minutes if that person that's telling me what to do as a trainer is full of shit, you know? Yep. And scary. And that's one of the reasons why I got back into it. You know, it's like I was always been known for, you know, telling it like it is, even if it's counterproductive, but I can always give you the why, but you know, and I don't see that in a lot of ways. And I guess maybe over time, this will correct itself. Still scary, man, to see some of the stuff that's out there, you know,
preach.
Yeah.
Preach on that.
Yeah.
I mean, like a lot of trainers or a lot of coaches may themselves have been good athletes because they were genetic specimens. Yeah. So then they figure that, oh, everyone else is going to be a genetic specimen.
Yeah,
too.
Exactly.
Here's my formula. This worked for me.
Yeah.
You know, there's a scalability issue that comes into play there that I think we don't necessarily respect enough. Add on top of that, you've got a lot of people that just want that like cool marketing.
Yeah.
So like the marketing people say, oh, just say this, you know, this program works for everybody. Horseshit. Like, no, it doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, so,
you know, some of my worst coaches that I had were star athletes because they were the guys that they could show you how they want. You know, I keep remembering in football, you know, this guy that one of my coaches, he was a star running back. Okay. So I'm in high school at this point. So instead of being able to communicate in a coherent way, what he wanted you to do, he would show you, here's how you do it. Well, that never translated in having a winning season. The athletes really they couldn't relate to that, even though I think that's a part of maybe coaching is showing how it needs to be done. But I think you have to be able to, a great coach knows how to communicate to get it through to the person that can take that information now and then use it on the, you know, in battle or on the field. And I think that plays to what you're saying. It's like, just because you're a great athlete doesn't mean that you're going to be a great coach.
Certainly. And I think what's important is that like the best coaches or the best leaders are the ones that like have empathy for the people that they're training or the people that they're leading.
Yeah.
So that they can moderate their message or they can tailor make their message to be able to pull at the right strings, whether it's up here or whether it's up here in the mind or whether it's here in the heart, right? To be able to motivate you in such a way that it produces the best outcomes.
Yeah.
But if you've got someone that's just like a physical specimen and total badass, then like, they're like, hey, what's wrong with you? Hey, you do this. Look at me. I'm old. I can still do this. Yeah. I can kick your ass.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways can be demoralizing.
Oh yeah. Right? Yeah. You can't, you know, a lot of people just can't relate to that. You know, you'll have that certain athlete that, you know, you'll get to, but I think what you're saying basically, and I agree, great coaches understand that you can't train all your athletes the same way. You can't get to all them by using one method. There's no possible way. And the great coaches know that, you know, and you can also see that on the field in the way athletes perform or don't perform. I totally agree with you on that. I'm going to switch gears a little bit here. With regard to, I know you talked about acupuncture, and along with that comes, I'm assuming that you believe in supplementation. Do you think that supplements out there on the market, do they work? And how does that differ or relate to herbal therapy? I'm assuming from listening to you that maybe you believe in herbs.
To me, it's not an issue of belief. It's an issue of like herbs are like food.
Okay.
You know, if you're talking about nutrition, or you're talking about food and diet, right? Like what works well for one person may actually cause an allergic reaction for someone else. So it's like, you hear stories of like NBA players, like before a game, having a peanut butter and jelly, which is great because you get a little bit of carbohydrate, a little bit of easy sugar, a little bit of protein, a little bit of fat,
yeah,
like in one comfortable, convenient little thing. And it gives you energy to play the game. What if you got someone with a peanut allergy?
Yeah.
You know, what if you got someone with like a high fructose corn syrup, like digestion issue?
Yeah.
So again, when it comes to supplements, when it comes to nutrition, when it comes to things like that, I'm a big proponent of like, we've got to tailor make, and because what one person handles well might totally bring out a negative reaction in someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to be patient, being able to be aware and observant of what's going on with the people that we deal with is clutch. Are there general guidelines as far as nutrition? Sure, there are, but nutrition and supplementation aren't my strongest points. So I'm kind of loath to speak on that as an expert. I think there are a lot of people out there that have put in a lot more man hours than I have and have great bodies of knowledge. But for myself, as far as my own particular experience, not only for my own body, but also with my patients and my clients, a lot of it is tailor-made. So like
you
see that also with the best East Asian, you know, herbal doctors, right? Like there are general guidelines for formulas, but those formulas are supposed to be tailor-made to each individual patient.
Yeah.
So we have like the catch-all kind of like easy net to cast wide.
Yeah.
Right. But you know, if we're looking for best results every time, every single time, those need to be tailor-made.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things I was really lucky, because my bodybuilding is pretty unique that way, because not only do you have to know exactly you have to be efficient in your training. In other words, you have to make every repetition count.
Yes.
And most people don't. And it's easier said than done to develop that. Every time you make a movement, it's counting. It's way harder than it sounds. But
yes,
the other thing that, so we had to know how to not only produce a result through training, but also to produce a result. And I know like in the beginning, we would do all kinds of exercises because we're experimenting. And then the longer you're in the sport, the next thing you know, all of a sudden less is doing way more than doing all the exercises that you did when you were first learning that. Okay. You had mm-hmm. that core group of exercises that always worked. And again, mm-hmm. just because it worked for me doesn't mean it would work for you, but you still had to get to that point. At some point, the same thing happened with nutrition with me. Now that, and I had a guy, Don Ross. He was called the Ripper Ross, and he was back in the 80s, very well known guy. He was a pro wrestler. He wrote for some of the muscle mags, and he said, you know, everything works to a degree, but it's to the degree that it works. And the thing that's unique about bodybuilding is that, listen, you can have the best training program out there, but if you can't support it with proper nutrition, you're not going to perform at at the highest level that you possibly could, because you need it for not only for the training, but also for the recovery. So I got really well versed on nutrition. And you know something? I actually know more about nutrition than most doctors that I run across.
Because, I believe it.
You know, because we had to know everything, just like we did with training. We had to know everything about protein, carbs, and fat. And how those things work together and how you can separate them. And, you know, you know everything about it. You become a student of the game in that area. You know, so for me, it was really interesting learning, you know, what was the best route to go? Was it taking 1 gram of protein for 1 pound of body weight, or half a gram? And I guess that's one of the things I was going to ask you. Do you monitor stuff like that when you have your athletes that you're training for, especially strength training? How important is protein intake?
I can't really speak on that as an expert, because that's not something that I work with them on. And most of these athletes that are operating at that level have their own nutritionists that they work with.
Gotcha.
So that's something that I leave to the people that are in their camps for that particular reason.
Gotcha. Okay. I was just curious that, you know, how that, if that was a part of your program. So you're really specialized then, it sounds like, in a certain area there. Now with kettlebell training, how did you learn that? And is that something that's a big part of your program?
Yeah. Kettlebells, I kind of stumbled along as it's kind of a funny story. One of my early patients was a gentleman by the name of Dan Inosanto. For those of your listeners that aren't familiar with Dan Inosanto, that name, you probably heard of his teacher, Bruce Lee.
Oh yeah, duh. Yes.
Mr. Inosanto was one of my patients. That's how I got to meet him. And then somewhere along the line, you know, I was like, wow, you know, I've been a fan of his for like since I was a kid. So, yeah. You know, just to have him as a patient was kind of a trip. And he'd always invite me to come down to the academy and train. And I'm like, oh, I just don't want to be an opportunist. And so like, I wouldn't do it. And then one time he goes, Doc, you know, I've got this guy that's coming to my academy, a Russian guy, to teach me some weightlifting stuff. And it's like, you've got my lower back feeling good for the first time in years. Would you mind coming along and just being there? So like, if he has me doing something that you feel uncomfortable with, you could object on my behalf. And if for some reason I get hurt, you can put me back together. I'm like, sure, sir, I'll be there. Roll over, and who's the Russian weightlifting coach but Pavel Tsitsulin himself.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. And so that's the very first time I got to see a kettlebell in real life and handle a kettlebell in real life was directly under Pavel's guidance. It's just kind of like one of those storybook things.
Yeah. Kind of like a chance meeting almost in a way.
It's one of those things that my life is full of a lot of those, but that's definitely one that I just have to shake my head and grin like, wow.
Yeah. And you know, the thing about it is I never have trained with kettlebells. I've watched people doing it on YouTube or whatever. Now, can you actually get certified as a kettlebell master or an instructor? Just, is it that specific?
I don't know if there's competitive in Eastern Bloc countries, and certainly I think in Russia, there are master of sport rankings with kettlebells. So there are certain lifts that you can do, certain amount of reps, certain amount of time,
okay,
based on the different federations. And those are competitive. But outside of those sport rankings, there are kettlebell instructorship certifications or kettlebell trainer certifications that people can take. But as far as being certified as a master instructor, in Strong First, for example, like there's a SFG, which is a Strong First kettlebell instructor. So there's level one, level two. And then after that, there are leadership levels that are by invitation only: team leader, senior instructor, and now master. And so that's how I'm at with Strong First and that idea.
Yeah. So when you're doing the kettlebell training, I know you're talking about these different levels, but so can you be certified just to do people like more for fitness as opposed to training athletes? Does it get like that? I mean, as far as being qualified enough to use kettlebells to train athletes?
Not really. I mean, I think the SFG level one, so the level one kettlebell instructorship certification that's available through Strong First. If you're really paying attention through that 3-day course, you're going to learn quite a lot that will serve you not only in terms of dealing with like the average individual that'll come in looking for like just a better tool for fitness and weight loss, as well as a professional athlete or Olympian. So,
So you're pretty well versed in, I mean, to some degree.
Should be. If you're listening and you're paying attention, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So let's tell me now where you're at right now. What's the path that you're on? Are you're continuing to do, with your training, but what's sort of the next thing for you down the road?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think the very next thing is as soon as all of this, all of the COVID shutdown lift up, to get back on the road and be traveling and then doing in-person workshops.
Okay.
That's something that I certainly miss. I mean, 2020 was going to be like one of my busiest years yet. But then that all ground to a halt very quickly.
Yeah.
But aside from that, really, I think being able to take best training practices and communicate to people in a more compelling way, where it changes the face of fitness from like the go hard or go home all the time.
Yeah.
Training methods to like go smart. and go wherever you want.
Yeah. So you're going to stay in that lane of, you know, teacher, coach, instructor. Sounds like that's sort of your path right there.
Kind of. I mean, like there's, I have a, like a, what I call an unfinished business tour.
Yeah.
Like things I wanted to wrap up before I hit 50. And, yeah. And I'm nearing 50 right now. So there are a few athletic goals that I'd like to be able to accomplish in terms of martial arts. One of which is to do special training in the black belt test in Shotokan under Tom and my teacher, Mr. Oshima. So that's one thing. I'm preparing for my third degree black belt test in Chinese wrestling, Shuai Jiao, which is, you know, there's a competitive element to that as well, in addition to knowing the curricular stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, there are a few other things as well. So I'd like to just be able to handle all of that, and make it through all of that successfully and then maintain. I also have a great curiosity for other martial arts that force me to push the envelope of my movement ability. You know, jumping, spinning, aerial stuff that most 50-year-olds don't really get into, you know, like I don't have a background in gymnastics or that sort of like more, visually exciting stuff. So for me to be able to push the limits of what I'm doing now, and like, where are the right points of access for someone that's my age to be able to get into doing that stuff in a sustainable way, rather than like, okay, you can Hail Mary it and then like blow your knees out.
Right.
Like, what's the right way to do that so that I can onboard myself in a way that's intelligent and then pass that on. So whether it's Capoeira Angola, whether it's parkour, whether it's these different movement systems that I'm not that familiar with, but that open up a whole new inventory of movement, that, again, that concept of inventory of movement, like what can we do to maximize, optimize, and then like build on those inventories of movement so that as we age, instead of those inventories shrinking and our body shrinking and our ranges of motion shrinking and our health potential shrinking, how do we optimize all of that?
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that's really evident for me talking to you, which, you know, I just talked to one of my assistants today. I said, you know, you can tell that you're very passionate about what you do. And I can tell that you are a student of the game. I have like this creed.
All I want.
Yeah. I have this, I call it the Serious Growth Creed. You know, Serious Growth is our training courses, you know, and there's six things that are in this creed from my perspective. And one of them is being a student of the game. I can tell that you're that guy. And one of them is also to question everything. And, you know, the thing about what I like and am attracted to you is that you have passion for what you do. And my uncle once told me, he says, you know, this is now my uncle's past, but he told me at a very, he was up in his age, and he said, you know, Leo, it's important to have something to look forward to. And I have to tell you, I'm 65 years old now. And Mark, I'm as excited about getting up in the morning to go to work and do the things that I'm doing now, if not more, because I appreciate it because of my age, than I was when I first started. And believe me, when I first started, I loved this shit so much. I did it for free, and only because I had to pay bills, I charged for it. And I still feel that way. And I think you're really lucky, and I think that I'm really lucky because I feel you that way.
Amen. You know, I've said countless times that, like, God, day in and day out, even on the shittiest of days,
yeah,
more often than not, I have to just shake my head in kind of gratitude and disbelief, because like I get paid well to do shit that I would pay to do.
Exactly.
It
doesn't get better than that, does it?
it's disbelief. I have to stutter in disbelief, because to be on this podcast with you, to train with people like Tom and Mr. Oshima, to have learned from Pavel Tsitsulin, and to be able to, you know, get a text message from Gray Cook or Dan Insano. It's like, to have these people to learn from, and to be also to be able to serve and work with all of these other people. It's just like
mind blowing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. And it's kind of like what you do. You shake your head, and it's like, I don't believe this, you know,
totally.
Here I am. You know, pretty awesome. Hey, listen, before we leave, would you like to promote anything on the show so people can reach you? Let us know about you.
That'd be an honor. I'm pretty active on social media. So on the big three, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, it's pretty easy to find me. My handle is at DrMarkCheng. So at Dr. Mark Cheng. And then if you want to find out more about K3, it's at K3 Combat. Again, across the same three handles. So, you know, it'd be an honor to have some of your listeners give me a follow and drop me a line every now and then and check out what I'm doing.
Right on, man. Well, listen, I really do appreciate you coming on the podcast. One of the things I love, you know, I ask myself, how can I be relative now when I came back? And I keep learning stuff when I talk to people like yourself. And that means a lot to me. And it means a lot that you took some time out to do that. So best of luck in everything that you're doing. And maybe by chance, we'll run into each other one of these days.
We'll have to engineer that to happen, sir.
Okay, man. You take care, all right?
Thank you. Thank
Be
you
well. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Serious Growth Podcast. For more episodes like the one you just listened to, subscribe to us on your mobile podcast app and leave us a review. If you'd like to reach out, you can find us online at seriousgrowth.com. Until next time, train smart and train hard.